Okay, so you basically started with philosophy, psychology, and I know that your main interests are there are many. Main interests are hormone physiology, reproductive biology, aging, and that kind of subjects.
Yeah, but, yeah. The reason I decided to study biology was that I didn't think people were working on consciousness in the right way. I thought I could get at it biologically.
Okay, excellent. Well, I know this evening's topic is going to be hopefully not too heady and too unreachable. I think hopefully what I'm hoping is that it will stir the imagination of people listening to see that, as I've always tried to explain, the world is a lot more than we see with our eyes. So the subject tonight of cognition, memory, and nutrition that supports successful memory forming and recapitulation and memory retention is going to be tonight's subject. Just want to mention that it seems strange, but when I was looking at the people, the pioneers of this subject in the last 100 years, there's a lot of Russians involved in it. And Dr. Pete, you mentioned a chap called Dostoevsky, Fyodor Dostoevsky, and gave an anecdote about a piece of the history that you related to his change in his perception, his cognition, as a result of imprisonment. So perhaps if we can start just by you recounting that, it might be enough to stir.
Yeah, in the biography written by Jim Rice, a professor at the University of Oregon, he tells the story about his nervous problems, whatever they were, that Dostoevsky had improved while he was in prison in Siberia. And one of the odd things was that he began eating chopped meat because that was available in the prison. I guess in the winter they didn't have vegetables available, and so they had to hunt and had meat available. And his consciousness improved, so the professor thought there might have been a nutritional aspect to his change of consciousness at different times in his life.
Okay, so we'll get into the subject in more detail, but are you supporting the necessary protein requirement in the diet? I know that some people don't want to offend
the
vegetarians.
If you're really seriously deficient in protein, it absolutely affects your consciousness. A professor friend of mine in Mexico said that when some of his students at the university couldn't memorize things, he encouraged them to eat some protein and would invite them to dinner and feed them some protein. And when I was teaching language classes in Mexico City, some of my students absolutely couldn't remember anything that we went over. And so I would start my classes with, I made funny little cookies out of eggs, sugar, and wheat germ. And I would serve those with a cup of coffee at the start of the class. And everyone was able to learn their lessons just with that little extra boost of protein, carbohydrate, and coffee.
Uh-huh. Okay, because I know we're going to mention some of those dietary supplements stroke nutrients, of which caffeine is one of them. Let's go on to explore the, the philosophy behind the current thinking based on some of these pioneering characters like Dostoevsky and Chomsky and there are several others that we'll hopefully get into a little bit later. In terms of the development of the understanding in which people remember things and the conscious versus the unconscious in everyday life, as well as the subject of gestalt or the deja vu experience. How do you and how have you seen this development occur from a linguistic background?
In the 19th century, what Dostoevsky was reacting to, for example, in his story, the Dream of a Strange Fellow, in which the hero of the story is suicidal because he sees the world as full of robots, people operating according to cause and effect, doing nothing other than what they're determined to do. And he's driven to suicide by that, but then has a dream that interrupts his suicide plan, and he comes back and becomes an advocate of the position of free will. At the time he was writing that, Europe, including Russia, was being swept by the mechanistic idea. Huxley, a friend of Charles Darwin, advocated the idea that molecules in the brain selected by evolution are absolutely in control of our thoughts, and our mind is simply a shadow of this determined mechanism. And Darwin said that he appreciated having such a nice robot friend. Darwin didn't approve of that mechanistic idea of consciousness, but he sort of joked about Huxley's mechanical belief. But that idea has persisted, and in my generation and subsequently, the outstanding figures have been Noam Chomsky with his idea that genes determine what he called rules, transformational rules, mm-hmm. that limit or determine what language, the form that language takes. And that the reason we can speak is because our genes specify these rules. But 30 years later, he said, well, rules can't explain anything, but lots of people didn't notice that he said it was all a mistake.
Okay.
Because, in fact, he still is sort of committed to all of that academic work, publication mm-hmm. on genetic determinism. And the so-called cognitive science and artificial intelligence are closely related to the Chomsky position. Using the digital computer as a model for understanding human intelligence. And since computers, since the late 1940s, have been digital computers rather than analog computers, that has led to a digitalization of their consciousness theories. But it's definitely not something that grew out of biological understanding necessarily, except through that robot philosophy of Huxley and others.
Now, I just want to interrupt a little bit. When you say Huxley, I think of Aldous Huxley, but...
okay. I can't think of his first name.
Oh, no problem.
The grandfather of Aldous.
Oh, okay. I was related then. Because he was the gentleman that wrote The Doors of Perception.
That was Aldous, the grandson.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Carry on. Okay, so you're saying that Chomsky did have a position that was, I think you're trying to say that he didn't have the position that was allied to the digital or the digitized.
The rules were determined by genes, so they were developed simultaneously with the the modeling of the brain in terms of the digital analog computer. And the idea that the brain cells communicate according to an on-off, all-or-nothing signaling mm-hmm. was derived from that same kind of quantizing philosophy that the switch of a digital computer, each bit of information is just on or off.
Right.
And that was taken up by biology with the idea that when a nerve fires and is active and then becomes quiet, that's all the information that was sent, one impulse, one bit of information. But P.K. Anokhin in Russia, who grew up with thinking such as Fyodor Dostoevsky's, was critical of that idea. And many other people have noticed that you can't explain hearing and the full range of volume, frequency, and tonal quality and such transmitted on nerves, which are only on-off switches.
Right, right.
And so P.K. Anokhin followed through many types of experiment and showed that it's probably impossible to explain brain function on the analogy of a computer using a binary digit types of information.
Right, being either on or off. I mean, I think we'd probably all want to imagine, certainly with the greatest of hope, that the digital on-off is definitely not what we are as people, and that there's so much more to biological living systems than what science would readily explain by the on-off. And that's how these kind of breakthroughs in quantum physics are occurring, and how the Einstein's theories are being challenged in terms of the latest thoughts on physics, and how matter is interacting and space and time all interact to produce this other dimension that I think we all like to imagine that we are living in a biological way, that we are influenced far more acutely by our environment, and that there's so much more to us than is going on that could otherwise be explained by nerve firing, as you say, the example of electrical impulses being generated, traveling down a nerve axon, crossing the synaptic cleft, reaching the receptor, having an effect, and then, you know, triggering a chemical impulse in the brain, say, or a secretion of a hormone or a neurotransmitter. There certainly is much more to thinking and cognition than just straight on off. So,
yeah, in Anokhin's view, it would be more like a picture traveling down each nerve, but not necessarily traveling at the time of the impulse, but that each nerve would be transmitting complex information, not just a bit. And these quantum related ideas, the essential ideas there are resonance and coherence.
Okay.
The interrelatedness of things separated in space and time.
Okay.
And those were part of biology back when Gestalt psychology was current in the 30s, 40s, and even into the 50s, people were still mm-hmm. arguing in favor of the Gestalt as being an image having a space-filling function in the brain, in some way reflecting the spatial and temporal arrangement in the real world. And that was developed at the same time that the field concept in embryology was the main line thinking. And all of those ideas were replaced by a digitalization and a mechanization of biological causality. around between 1945 and 1950. And in that pre-computer time, quite a few people were talking about the resonance from sensory interactions. For example, in the nose, it would be a molecule vibrating, stimulating some kind of an analogous vibration, so that in effect, the actual aroma of a molecule would be reproduced along the nerve and in the brain, so that the brain itself would contain the smell, in effect. Or when an image, when light is absorbed by vitamin A molecule in the retina, it would excite a resonance of a similar luminous quality that would travel down the nerve and be reproduced in the brain, so that in the Gestalt view, you would actually have something like a luminous event in the brain when you saw light in the world.
What makes me think at this point in time, I'm thinking of those, not for the sake that it was found to be a little bogus in the end, but the Uri Geller type effect, where he was shown, or if someone was shown a picture, an image of a star, and they were going to transmit this to Uri by thought, that kind of thing, I'm sure does exist, and that is something that can be either learned or can be exercised in terms of thoughts traveling across space from one place to another, and how that can be incorporated into the kind of growing brain, if you like, through exercise or through through exercise of that kind of behavior. Is that resonance or that coherence anything similar to that kind of model, where it's an extrasensory perception is transmitted across space from one person to another without actually the other person seeing the object?
There are several experiments currently going on. The Noetic Institute, I think, has one with random number generators, but on the internet you can see several very interesting experiments. Michael Persinger, a neurologist, has some interesting publications and videos in which he is arguing for a resonance between everyone's brain and the electromagnetic resonance frequencies of the Earth environment, and the Earth resonating as a unit which can be sort of a medium through which individuals can resonate.
Okay, let me hold it, just get you to hold it there for a moment. You're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM, and from 7:30 until the end of the show at 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with any questions, either related or unrelated to this month's subject of cognition, memory, and nutrition. Once again, we have guest speaker Dr. Raymond Peake bringing his 40-plus years of study on top of his academic background to bear on the subject. We are going to get into the subject of brain nutrition in a while, but just to let people know that from 7:30 on, calls are welcome. Dr. Peake, that reminds me of anxiety, and you mentioned the Noetic Institute, so I was going to bring up the subject of the noosphere, and that was proposed by a Russian, Vladimir Vernadsky. But is this Noetic Institute, it's the same thing, it's an institute for the study of the noosphere, perhaps, is it?
Of consciousness?
Yeah, didn't you mention Michael Persinger and the Noetic Institute?
I don't know who's in charge of the Noetic Institute right now, but...
All right. But there is an institute that's studying that, the world of the mind, as it were, the world of conscious thought.
Yeah, that's included. Priest Teilhard de Chardin followed Vernadsky's idea of the world becoming more and more conscious with supporting the growth of more and more conscious organisms, specifically people.
Yeah. Okay, and you know what? We actually have a caller, so let's take this first caller and see what direction we're going in. Okay, caller, you're on the air, and where are you from?
Hi, I'm calling from Mendocino. This is Jeff right on Mendocino Coast. It's a beautiful day in paradise, as we say here. Yeah, I got a question for you, Dr. Pete, and I always appreciate your brilliant enlightenment to us all here, and you taking the time to do this. I have heard of several cases where music is used for therapy for people who end up comatose and with spinal injuries, and it has led me to make the statement about magical, mystical, medicinal, musical moments, and those cumulatively can help people come back. It helps us on a daily basis by releasing endorphins, which the insurance companies haven't figured out a way to get from us yet. No suggestions allowed on that one. But good music always, you know, brings those spinal chills and good feelings to the body. And in going with the resonance of the universe, since everything is vibration, including string theory, strings vibrate on musical instruments, I'd just like to kind of put that out, and I'll leave the line and see how you respond to that. And thanks again for all you do, man.
Okay, thanks for your call. So, Dr. Pete, how about music therapy?
Yeah, I think it's something much more subtle but more powerful than endorphins. I think the very structure of nerves is a kind of resonance and carries possibly by as a semiconducting system, but it carries a function that's analogous to the objective music outside the body. And so when you give the organism a chance to relax and begin to respond to the music, you're reinforcing or enabling a process that is very basic to the life of the brain cells and all of the living organism. If you believed in the mechanistic cognitive science, artificial intelligence interpretation of consciousness, you would see the present moment as an infinitesimally thin division between past and future that's moving along like a line on a graph, analogous to a certain measurement of depth, width, and height, except moving along the timeline. But the unreality of that, complete nonsensicalness of it, in fact, you can see when you whistle a tune or listen to music or see a performer who is doing in an intricately whole and organized way song or other performance, a director who can organize everything in the orchestra to produce the desired effect, is having to see where the particular moment is going and where it has been, the pace of the music and all of the qualities that are developing in each moment depend on what you're perceiving to come and as recently passed. So the brain is like a musical composition. It doesn't exist only in the present. The moment of consciousness spans time so that you're simultaneously present in an infinity of these infinitesimally thin presences.
Interesting. Okay, I just another thought process has gone off in my mind of the Buddhistic kind of teachings of stilling the mind as being a way to enlightenment. And I wanted to bring up the other subject of you mentioned that there was some test that was done, and it took groups of people, some of who were lying down to perform the test, and some of which were standing up to perform the test, and how measurably better they did when they were lying down. So how do you see that stilling the mind and releasing yourself from anxiety as a mechanism to which your brain would be more active, more effective?
I think it's a matter of the breadth of time that your consciousness, when you're standing up, you're ready to react quickly, but to a short-term influence. When you're lying down, you refer your reference of meaning goes out farther in all directions. What you're going to do and what you've been doing come into the picture. And that allows you to achieve a better product in whatever you're thinking about than if you're under the pressure of meeting an immediate result. And when you're standing up, you're ready to move quickly. When you're lying down, you're relaxed, and your mind can go out in time and space.
That's probably some of the reason why the psychologists want you lying on the couch whilst they conduct their inquiry.
And when you're under stress, glucose is the immediate source of energy. Electrons probably are the immediate source. The carbon dioxide produced from the glucose acts to modify the electronic properties of your cell so that it can perform these resonant, coherent interactions. But glucose is the material that keeps that conscious process possible. And if you're under stress and are using your glucose too fast or don't have enough of it available, then your nervous processes go into an emergency state where only the here and now, the immediate present and location are relevant. And so anxiety associated with hypoglycemia or stress will flatten the way your consciousness works. And it might give you quick reactions, but they aren't necessarily going to be the most interesting reactions.
Again, so once again, we've... touting glucose as positive, helpful, creative, energetic, when constantly, I can't believe the amount of times I see adverts for low sugar this, low sugar that, and hear people talking about how bad sugar is, and it does this and it does that and it causes cancer, and it's completely the opposite. I don't know how people can be so brainwashed.
If a person has been under stress and not eating very well, besides protein, vitamin B1 is sometimes the thing that can make the biggest difference most quickly. When it's absorbed, if you've been deficient in it, a great deficiency can cause psychosis and hallucinations and so on, but a mild deficiency can just make you feel sluggish and depressed and not have a very good short-term memory, not able to remember what you want or function as acutely as you should. When you take that in a deficient condition, suddenly your whole mood and world seems to change.
What kind of dose would you say physiologically is sufficient?
Experienced it with as little as 10 milligrams.
Okay.
But if it's just for an emergency, 100 milligrams is okay.
All right, we actually have another caller on the air. So let's, before we lose the thread of that B1 deficiency, let's take this next caller. You're on the air, and where are you from?
Hello, is that me?
Yeah, you're on the air. Where are you calling from, caller?
Hi, I'm from New Jersey.
New Jersey, hi.
I've been on before, and I thank you so much for what you do. This is just a fascinating show. Dr. Pete, I was reading, and I'm so sorry this shows you where my, you know, sort of brain fog is. I deleted this beautiful quote about how neurogenesis can take place in the hippocampus, but also in the olfactory bulb. And it went on to describe how, if I'm remembering, the hippocampus could be stimulated by exercise, but, I think we are, you know, hearing that from so many quarters that maybe we don't need to explore that. I would like to explore the olfactory aspect. Can one, like, go around smelling things and, you know, start firing neurons or creating new neurons?
Luca Turin, a perfume specialist, has some very good videos on the Internet, one on pharmacology, but he's talking about antidepressant drugs in that case, but really his main interest is in olfaction. And I think that along with Heraclitus, who talked about the nose essences as being at the center of consciousness, olfactory system is very closely connected with our highest and best conceptual work.
Wow.
You
said Luca Turin?
L-U-C-A.
And the second name was who?
First name is L-U-C-A, Luca, and Turin, T-U-R-I-N, last name.
Okay. And then you mentioned another individual. Am I right?
Another name?
A different person.
I don't recall.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll listen to the archived version. And would we have to, I mean, I guess what you're saying is that, you know, I'm going to explore this. I'm going to look into this. But in your understanding, would we perhaps have to surround ourselves with a particular kind of smell? I mean, if you know, I mean, would it have to be acrid or as opposed to sweet or, do you understand me?
No, becoming conscious of the smells around you. And each type of smell has its inclination to reinforce certain types of function. But the whole process of becoming conscious of odors in your environment, that's very closely connected with the higher parts of the brain. Conceptually, you can use odors to stimulate memory. The way they connect to the rest of the brain, you can sometimes, with a thought, you can associate the memory of a smell, and sometimes the smell can bring back certain types of thought. And the stimulation of the hippocampus, any type of experience helps to stimulate that. For example, taxi drivers in a big city who have learned all the streets have a bigger hippocampus. But stimulation works everywhere in the brain. Nerve cells are maintaining each other so that anything you do consciously is tending to enliven the rest of your brain. It just happens that vision and smell are among the very powerful things. Music has the function of extending us through the moment, expanding our moment that we feel present. But the mechanists proposed an idea of memory that was sort of like a computer, in which you could, in one type of computer, you could say that memory was punching a hole in a piece of paper or putting a signal on a tape, some definite thing that you could find later, go back to that card or that tape and repeat that signal. And so they said, well, there's some kind of a signaling process in the brain in which we might make a specific protein or RNA molecule and sort of drop it in a certain location for later use. But if you think about the type of process that you would have to go through to find the right memory molecule when you needed it, the process and apparatus with which you would find that molecule already explains that you know where it is that you have the memory. So you already have the memory, in effect, if you can go to find the molecule. Otherwise, molecules would just be jumping at you randomly, and your memory would be like a computer that spews out things at random.
And yet, as I think you indicated, I know sometimes I've smelled something and it has evoked memories that I thought were forgotten.
Heraclitus was the person I mentioned, the Greek philosopher. So many people have noticed that an odor can recall a whole situation that you thought you had forgotten.
Many thanks. Much fun. I'm going to say bye-bye for now. Bye.
Okay, thank you for your call, caller. Okay, so we've got Dr. Ray Peet on the show with us tonight. We're exploring cognition, memory, and nutritional factors that will support cognition and memory. Number here, if you live in the area, is 923-3911, or if you're outside the area, there's a toll-free number, which is 1-800-KMUD-RAD. Okay, so 8 o'clock, people were invited to call in. Dr. Peet, getting back to nutrition, you talked about B1 deficiency as a cause of a poor cognition and using as little as 10 milligrams. And I know that those foods that typically people might associate the B1 would be things like sunflower seeds and bread, but there are other things. I heard that macadamia nuts have some B1 in them. Are there any other sources of B1 that you say would be, a good quality source of B1?
Oh, all of the animal foods.
Okay.
Eggs, milk, cheese.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. And I wanted to question you a little more about vitamin A. I know you said, and link this with anxiety when you're very keen to stress that anxiety puts us in a very bad position to be able to remember things, to learn things, to have our brain working properly. And the whole anti-anxiety supplements that would reduce anxiety, things...
Yeah, vitamin A, besides being a matter of sensitivity to electronic excitation, such as in the eye, and acting sort of as an antenna for interacting with electromagnetic energy. The other region of vitamin A activity is in activating the enzymes that make steroids, and especially brain steroids, so that if your vitamin A is deficient, you not only have poor vision and skin problems and so on, but your ability to make pregnenolone, progesterone, DHEA, and their derivatives is limited. Mm-hmm. And the brain is the major steroid-forming organ. The skin, the gonads, adrenals, and the brain. The brain is probably the most powerful steroid-forming organ when it's working right. And vitamin A is essential for making those.
Yeah. Okay. I got a thought about the misplaced belief that fish oils are good for you, although there is a lot of vitamin A in halibut liver oil. And I think in the past, when we've discussed vitamin A and its sources, that halibut oil has such a concentrated form of vitamin A and so little PUFA, which is the whole, you know, the whole point of avoiding the fish oils, that it's relatively safe. I know liver will contain it too, but what else would you say about, you know, the amount of vitamin A in liver, for example, as a good nutritional food source versus halibut liver oil?
Well, the halibut liver oil gives you a lot of vitamin A and some vitamin D, and probably traces of vitamin E as well,
mm-hmm.
and not too much of the PUFA. So
right.
it's a good source.
Okay.
The liver itself, fish liver or chicken liver, right. beef liver, any kind of liver is a great source of vitamin A.
Yeah. And then eggs, I guess, are another...
Yeah. And milk and cheese.
Of course, dairy. Okay.
And vitamin B12 happens to be crucial for turning carotene into vitamin A.
Okay. All right. So there's three things there then that can be definitely relegated to the brain food section. So vitamin A, B1, and then B12 because of its help converting carotene, beta carotene to vitamin A. What kind of things would use up someone's, apart from somebody not consuming enough vitamin A in their diet, there are definitely things that will consume vitamin A so that even if you do eat some of those vitamin A containing foods, you may actually be deficient?
Ultraviolet exposure destroys it very easily in your skin. And that's one of the things involved in sunburn. Vitamin A reacts with the ultraviolet and then spreads the damage to any unsaturated fats that are in your skin.
Huh. Interesting. So in this sense, then sunlight exposure is not particularly good for you, although, you know, you have to weigh up the pros and cons of adequate vitamin D from sunlight and or... the other beneficial effects of red light and the electron quenching.
And vitamin E protects against that breakdown and destruction of vitamin A.
Is that right? Okay, so if you were to supplement with vitamin E, and again, a vitamin E supplementation would be coming from something like wheat germ oil, but any other...
Liver and
milk
and butter all have some vitamin E.
Right. Okay, so... there are other factors then that would increase someone's ability to retain information and or develop, for want of a better word, new connections. And energetically, that's an important consideration. If you don't have sufficient energy in the system to drive those things, then it's not going to be possible to work efficiently. And I know that you would suggest thyroid and other maybe pregnenolone or progesterone as anti-estrogen substances that would also work towards that.
Serotonin is when you're under stress or are eating irritating foods, your intestine gets inflamed and releases extra serotonin, which... some of it can get to the brain and signal the stress system, and then signaling the stress system can activate other serotonin-producing systems, so it can create a vicious circle.
Would this be part of an endotoxin-type scenario?
Endotoxin triggers nitric oxide and serotonin. And various types of stress and depression tend to slow nerve function in many ways, and people experience it as a feeling of need to withdraw, being depressed or anxious, sometimes defensive and aggressive. If you feed rats beans, for example, containing the soluble fibers that can feed bacteria that create irritation and increase the serotonin, the rats become both anxious and aggressive, fearful but defensive and quick to attack.
Okay, because I what I'm getting from this is that anxiety is probably one of the main main things to avoid in terms of having a competent memory and a competent cognition. That the whole physiological effect of stress and anxiety are all working against having that kind of stillness that would enable one to recapitulate events or to remember even simple facts.
And hyperventilation, for example, when you're feeling anxious, it's common to breathe harder and deeper and lose carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide seems to be a nerve stabilizer, protects nerves against many types of stress and inflammation. And as the carbon dioxide goes down, your platelets release more serotonin and probably other inflammatory things. And so just hyperventilating is enough to trigger a process that tends to slow you down, make you retreat, and not think very clearly.
Hmm.
And so, interestingly, anything that will increase your ability to retain carbon dioxide tends to help you think calmly and clearly.
And you say that thyroid does that. It helps you retain CO2?
Yeah, thyroid and progesterone and pregnenolone, all of the anti-stress things.
Yeah.
And
that reminds me about magnesium carbonate. I was thinking about that earlier as not a laxative, but definitely as a product which will produce a relatively smooth bowel movement. And not to joke too much about it, but in itself, magnesium carbonate would liberate some CO2 in that sense, wouldn't it?
Thyroid lets your cells retain the magnesium. So magnesium carbonate is, in a way, a short-term thyroid supporter. Keeping your brain warm is another thing that just running at a higher temperature, your brain produces more CO2 and generally will retain the magnesium more efficiently as if it's under the influence of thyroid.
Right. So the thyroid hormone itself, in a healthy individual with adequate thyroid function, that would be it would happen anyway. So you'd be running at an adequately warm enough temperature for your brain to be doing that.
Yeah, I've known many people who complained about memory problems and a foggy consciousness, sense of being in a fog, and they often had a temperature, oral temperature of 96 or under 97 degrees, and getting their brain temperature up towards 98 or 99 degrees Fahrenheit, their memory improves tremendously. I've noticed when I was in school, if I had neglected to study for a test, if I would take some vitamin B1 the night before and then read the book and then take some just before the test, I mentioned that to a couple of other people, and it has worked for everyone I know who has tried it. They always got perfect A's on their tests.
Well, you've let your secret out. Okay, so let me just think. Okay, yeah, I was just kind of go back to sodium. I know you've mentioned that sodium itself, and again, this is another controversial subject, but that's what this show's all about, I think. It's not so much controversy, but it's actually the truth, and it sounds so shocking that it seems to be controversial. But sodium in the form of regular table salt, and I know we've done lots of different shows or interjected shows with mentioning how good and positive and healthful and beneficial salt is for you, even though that most of the advertising media wants to tell you how bad it is, just like sugar. That salt itself is very important in terms of retaining the magnesium that you're saying.
And stress and aging tend to make it harder to retain the sodium. Hyponatremia is a big problem for sick old people. But occasionally it happens in hypothyroid younger people because the thyroid making carbon dioxide is an important factor in retaining sodium so it doesn't get lost in the urine. And when your body is sensing too much loss of sodium, the adrenals produce aldosterone to save the sodium, and aldosterone tells the kidneys to lose magnesium. And so if you take enough sodium to keep your adrenals from making aldosterone, your kidneys are going to save magnesium. So in that situation, eating extra salt is going to be equivalent to having more magnesium in your diet, because you'll lose it less quickly.
Yeah. I mean, you're an advocate of salting your food and using salt in recipes and, yeah.
Yeah, salt, protein, progesterone, and thyroid are the main things for keeping your brain temperature up and functioning well.
Okay, well, unfortunately, it's coming up for 3 minutes to 8 o'clock, so in order to let people know more about you, I'll have to cut the show short there, but thank you so much for joining us again. And sharing your wisdom with us.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so for those people who've been listening, if you want to find out more about Dr. Raymond Peete, you can visit his website. And that website address is www.raypeete.com, R-A-Y-P-E-A-T.com. There's lots of articles there. He's not selling anything. He's just so into what he's doing that he's passionate enough about it to put it all on his website, and it's fully referenced. So if you want to learn more about some of those things that you think are controversial that we've mentioned, like salt is good for you or sugar is good for you, please take a look at his website, and you'll find out, for those people who have any need to know the science behind it, it's the best place to go. For those people who are perhaps not so interested about the science but just want to understand it a little more, it may seem a little heady, but it's all fully referenced, and his work is pioneering. I can't say anything less than that. A lot of what he's said and espoused is certainly being taken up by even the mainstream, and I know recently, in this last 12 months at least, polyunsaturated fats are now being looked at as the bad guys, which is what he's always said, that the polyunsaturates, the liquid oils, the fish oil, it's all the bad stuff, and that salt and sugar is actually very beneficial for you. There's many different reasons why. Okay, so raypeete.com. And for those people who want to contact us Monday through Friday, we can be reached at 1-888-WBM-HERB. So every third Friday of the month, it's the show Ask Your Herb Doctor. So until June of next June, here we go, in the middle of summer already. Gosh, it's only a few weeks away from the solstice. Hey, until June, we wish you all good night. Good night.